What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devinder Hardwar. This week, I'm joined by Engadget Reporter Malek Saleh to talk about some news. What's up, Malek?
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Happy to have you here. And you will also hear Ms. Sherlyn Lowe's voice at some point. She is remote. She is off at the Apple campus. She did the hands-ons with the new iPhones. So you will hear Sherlyn's hands-on thoughts on the iPhone 15, the Apple Watch Series 9. If you are here looking for immediate iPhone reactions, go back and listen to the bonus episode we launched this week. It was me and Engadget Editor-in-Chief Dana Wollman. We immediately responded to the Apple event, so we broke down the specs, the features, our initial thoughts on those things. So all your Apple stuff, check out the episode behind this one. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to the Engadget Podcast on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. Also, leave us a review on iTunes. That's super helpful, too. And yeah, let's get right to it. To my chat with Sherlyn about her thoughts on all the new Apple products. Joining us to talk about everything that happened at Apple's Wonderlust event is Sherlyn Lowe, Deputy Editor. What's up, Sherlyn?
I am wondering why the hell I am still here. No,
I mean, you know why you're still there. You don't want to fly out right after the event. Come on.
I have, I just got like a new meeting, so it's actually a good thing I am staying today, the extra day. But
oh, nice.
Yeah, currently in San Francisco. And I'm exhausted. I got plagued by all the flight delays that were, you know, troubling the East Coast. That was fun. So I got in at like 1 a.m. to the Apple event.
Oh, man. Before. Well, yeah. Luckily, you didn't miss it, at least. Like, it could have been so much worse. So Dana and I talked about all the major Apple news. So we went over all the specs and everything in our initial thoughts. So really, Sherlyn, you're free to tell us, like, what are your overall thoughts? And I've got some questions for you. But what's your main takeaway from this Apple event?
I mean, it's two things that stand out to me, I think, and I've made puns of them in my hands-on coverage, which is I'm pretty intrigued by this action button on the iPhone 15 Pro, and then I'm also very into the double-tap gesture on the watch.
Yeah.
Now, let's start with watch. I did two briefings yesterday with Apple, so to, you know, where you get kind of to ask all kinds of questions, get kind of a deeper walkthrough of each product. And I think that on the watch side of things, with the new S9 SIP, enabling on-device Siri, making it so that Siri can now, you know, give you your health requests or let you edit your health details through voice, I actually think that might be more underrated and quietly groundbreaking than we think.
I think that is the thing that's really pushing me to this watch, too. I'm
going
to just for that.
Yeah. I can tell you, I think that like Siri, first of all, if you've used Apple Watch at all so far, you know Siri requests just suck because it takes forever for it to find like the signal. It needs to go to the cloud to process all of that stuff.
It has to hit your phone first, and then your phone hits the cloud, and then meanwhile you're like, I'm waiting, Siri, please respond. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was slightly annoyed because on the plane here to SF from Newark, I had a mask on because, you know, it's just gross. And so I was unlocking my phone the whole time just to like text people, frustrated that I was still on the tarmac 4 or 5 hours later.
Oh,
and
man.
I know, but the thing is, I eventually had to enable the feature where, like, if you know, unlock with your iPhone with your Apple Watch, right? Because I can't, the mask thing was just not recognizing my face. Fine, but like the number of times that didn't work really frustrated me. It worked very well, about I want to say 85% of the time, and then it just didn't work for some. I'm kind of worried that like even after, you know, improving Siri, enabling on-device Siri, and making that faster, that there might still be little like quirks in the way that
make the
experience frustrating. But I can tell you this, I do think it, like we said, is a quiet game changer. I think that using your voice to interact with your watch and using your voice to track your health stats like that is something that sets Apple apart from Samsung's Galaxy watches. And even though the Pixel Watch and Google offer good voice assistant and tight integration with the assistant, I don't think on the same level though. So
can you take a step back, Sherlyn? Just tell us, what was the health interactions? Because we heard that, yeah, Siri commands will be on demand. So that's just like weather and stuff. But what are you referring to specifically for health?
Yeah. So I'm talking about Siri health requests. Like, because now you can process Siri requests on the watch, it is not being sent somewhere to be processed. Apple is now, I guess, more trusting of the process for people to talk to Siri to do things like, hey, Siri, add 1 cup of water to my daily intake. Or something. Hey Siri, how many steps left to my goals? Hey, whatever. how many calories have I burned today, start a workout, all of those things. Basically anything to do with tracking your daily health, how much, or asking about your health. So like, how many hours did I sleep last night?
Yeah,
that sort of thing. It's
wild. I would love that for like grocery list stuff too, because I always have trouble like keeping track of grocery lists on my phone. So if I could just like talk to my watch, and that's the dream. I don't know if you're, I guess, aware of the comic stuff, Sherlyn, but like Dick Tracy is what everybody goes to talking to your watch, or like James Bond stuff, or even Knight Rider. But you know, we want to just talk to our watches more easily and have them actually do stuff. So this is cool. So did you actually get to test that out during your hands-on?
Yeah, none of that Siri stuff was, ready for testing. Not that it wasn't ready. I think nobody was able to test that feature. What I did test was double tap. And I think I can talk a little bit more about that here, which is double tap, for anyone that hasn't watched the Apple event, is a new gesture where your watch hand can now let you interact with your smartwatch without touching it. In the same way that the Siri requests do. But imagine you're cooking or your grocery shop, or you're out on a run and everything.
Right.
And your watch buzzes and there's a message, or your watch buzzes and there's a workout that you forgot to start. Instead of having to lift your wrist and swipe through whatever, and you might have grimy fingers or you're running and you don't want to stop to do it.
It's just hard on the watch too. Like, small screen, you got to like,
oh my God, it's so awful. Yeah. I can't tell you the number of times I've been like walking and I forgot to start the outdoor walk workout, and it prompts me and I'm like, shit, I have to like tap, tap, tap. And the tap doesn't always work because it's like, it's two steps to it. Anyway, now you can use the double tap gesture, which is bringing your thumb to your index finger twice in rapid succession. So double tap, right? It's like a double click, but
it's an air click, basically, like an air double click, which I was also impressed by this, Sherlyn. This is one of those things, weirdly, we geek out about just random gestures and stuff.
I know.
But when I tested out the Vision Pro, there's a very similar gesture for accepting things and for saying okay. And clearly, I think what's happening here, and I talked about this with Dana, is that Apple's just training us. Apple's training us for all the new gestures we're going to be relying on for the Vision Pro, or like future headsets from them. I don't know if you remember the movie Snowpiercer. It also feels a little bit like that. Like, well, everybody has the gesture of like turning and twisting because you had to fix this machine when you were a child. So it's just this weird thing that Apple is going to introduce to our culture. I do think it's useful. And they're also they're tracking in a cool way, right? They said they're tracking tiny movements in your hand. They're tracking blood flow in your hand to track that gesture. That's cool.
So what I'm I asked a lot about this. So I actually, in our briefing with other people, I somehow monopolized the conversation just to talk about double tap and how it differs from assistive touch. So to be clear, assistive touch was rolled out in 2021 to Apple Watch, Watch OS. For anyone with a Series 4 and up to be able to navigate their smartwatch, even if they don't have maybe a second limb, a second arm, or index finger or fingers, right? So to just use the touchscreen. So assistive touch was an accessibility-minded feature that would allow users to use things like clenching your fist or rotating your limb to kind of navigate through watchOS. Assistive touch is different from double tap. And this is, again, why I monopolized the conversation, because I wanted to understand what was going on here.
Good, yeah.
Assistive touch is very different, in the sense that it is something have to first go in and turn on in your watch. And then it will do this little outline where it's prompting you, hey, is this what you want? Jumping through each element on the screen, if you clench your fist, that sort of thing. Whereas double tap is enabled by default. You don't have to do anything to turn it on. And it's available anytime something kind of like happens or is there. So basically, from your home screen on the Apple Watch Series 9 or Watch Ultra 2, you lift your wrist. It's active. Your watch has to be unlocked and awake, basically, for you to use double tap. And when you double tap from the home screen, it will bring up the Smart Stack, which is a feature introduced in Watch OS 10 at WWDC this year. Basically, a list of cards under the home page that are, you know, intuitively sort of guessing at what you want to do the rest of your day. So then once you bring up the Smart Stack with your first double tap, the second or subsequent double taps can do either scroll through the cards on Smart Stack, or if you change the setting in your phone or your watch, it will like launch into the first card or the card at the top. So that's kind of the main way you can do it. But the other way that Double Tap works is whenever sort of an alert is open or pops up on your watch, or if you have a timer app open, that sort of thing, double tapping basically triggers the primary action button on that app. So if you've opened the timer app, but you haven't started one, if you double tap, you will start the timer. And then double tapping it pauses it or stops it. And then when it's ringing and it comes up, then double tapping it, you know, snoozes it or dismisses it. That's it happens cool. for calls and all of that stuff. Yeah. It's what Apple is doing is using the same tools it uses to detect blood flow anomalies in your wrist, which would, you know, earlier before Double Tap was introduced, was used to tell you if you had like heart irregularities, heart rate irregularities, right?
So it's using, if you like optical, press your fingers together, you probably have like a weird blood flow like blip or something.
You have a restriction a disruption to your blood flow basically. And so it's not only using that, because I was like, you can't, that's not the only thing, piece of information you're using. So they're using that with along with accelerometer and gyroscope information to tell when you're pinching. And so it resulted in something that was somewhat, I think, accurate. I think in my testing of it, which I spent a lot of time just trying to trick the system at the hands-on demo area, I was just like, okay, does tapping my third finger make a difference? It doesn't work if you touch your middle finger. And I was like, oh, does using my thumb to touch my knuckle trigger the double tap? Nope, it didn't. So yeah, it's pretty precise. I think also the fact that it has to be a double tap and not just one tap prevents the accidental triggers a lot more.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So it comes off more deliberate when you're doing it. I mean, I don't know. It's something simple, but I feel like I'm a little bit, you know, surprised and wowed.
Simply yet brilliant, I think, is one of the, like, this is just a purely Apple thing in a way, because we've seen other companies try like gestures, like Samsung and LG have tried like, hey, on your front facing camera, you can swipe your phone and your phone will move. And that stuff never really worked. Whereas this seems like more generally useful. I want to say you brought up assistive touch, which is a feature on the Apple Watch and iPhone. There's also back tap on iPhone, with iOS 14, where you can like tap the back of your phone. So that is also an accessibility feature, which is something not many people are aware of, but you can do all sorts of cool stuff like this. I almost wonder, Sherlyn, if Apple's going to like unlock other gestures that you could program to do some things, like if you just stick up a middle finger with your while you're wearing your watch, does it take a screenshot of somebody in front of you because they're being annoying, like something like that? Like I can imagine that would be cool, programming those gestures.
I think we're starting to see Apple think about hands-free interaction with our devices way more now that we've got, together with Vision Pro, together with Apple Watch, you're thinking about how you're seeing how Apple envisions its combined device ecosystem more. This year, in fact, that might be the theme. I think we're thinking about when Google, I think a few years ago, was telling me about its idea of ambient computing, kind of that being its vision for the years forward. We're starting to see this idea kind of coalesce with Apple. I wouldn't be surprised if we see more gestures. Obviously, I don't think Apple being Apple would ever enable anything to do with the middle finger. But I think this quite naturally brings us to the action button. But I do want to quickly, like, you know, I'm sure you already know sort of some of the updates on the Apple Watch Series 9 and Ultra 2. But it's also a good point to kind of talk about fine woven, I guess. I've talked about...
about them giving up on leather, which is interesting. Yeah. Tell me about fine woven, which is the new material they're kind of pushing instead.
Fine woven is part of Apple 2030, which I don't know if you and Dana have talked about this, but our team rightly called out how vague this silly little term is. Honestly, Apple 2030, it's our green thing for goals. Yeah, sure. It's really, the company wants to be net carbon neutral by the year 2030. And it's, you know, did a giant sketch featuring Octavia Spencer as Mother Nature to kind of break down what's going on. But I think it ended up being distracting more than it really helped me understand what was happening here. They did follow it up with a more informative presentation that talked about how they're trying to get to carbon neutral. So the Apple Watch Series 9 and Ultra 2 are, this is the first Apple Watches that are fully carbon neutral, especially if you pair them with certain bands. So if you use a sport loop, it's carbon neutral for sure, because there's no metal on the bands. So
I think it's worth keep saying they brought up the term carbon net neutral. And I think that is
net carbon neutral.
Actually key, because it's like talking about net profits, right? It is it is the carbon after they put in all the we planted some forests, so let's cut off that carbon from the cost of this. Yeah.
And Apple itself will bring this up a lot, in the sense that like they're aware that net carbon neutrality is kind of flawed of a way to describe things, right? Because you can easily achieve net carbon neutrality if you have a lot of money to buy carbon credits, you have a lot of money to plant trees and forests, but that doesn't really solve the issue of waste, of like carbon emissions, really. So what Apple is stressing that is that like it's really trying to look at its manufacturing processes, its products, and reducing the amount of like new wasteful material going into it, and using a lot of recyclable materials. I don't know how much I commend them for this. I think it's good that Apple is paying attention, right? But I don't know how much I can see this.
We've got to be aware. Like a lot of companies do this. Like a lot of companies talk about how good they are to the environment, right? And Dana and I were talking about the concept of greenwashing, where these companies will be like, yeah, we bought all these carbon credits, we planted some trees, therefore we are doing good. It's something, but there have been a lot of studies that carbon credits specifically don't actually amount to much when it comes to actual waste. Yeah.
I mean, my one last thought around just this general idea of greenwashing and like making themselves look good is that ultimately Apple's goal is still to get you to buy more iPhones and Apple Watches, which is still quite wasteful if you think about it. But anyway, moving on to fine woven, it's part of this Apple 2030 vision in the sense that Apple is like, oh, leather bad for environment, let's no leather. So not only is Apple no longer selling leather accessories, it's also kind of working with some of its partners like Hermes and Nike to no longer sell their leather accessories through the
Hermes
Apple Store.
Hermes is not giving up on leather. Hermes will never give
Hermes
up on leather.
Hermes itself is not giving up on leather, but the Apple Watch has made some of these new woven bands that I think Hermes is like, yeah, cool. These are nice, but they're not our standard
it's,
Hermes.
It's kind of funny because Apple is both sort of shaming them. Yeah. Like, look at you, high class, $1,000 leather bag company. Please work with us to create this other thing.
It's quite funny. So for Apple's own its own made accessories and bands, it's come up with fine woven, which is a material that it's kind of created itself. I think it's part some of it. Something like 60-something% of it is made from recycled material, and it's meant to be also kind of premium feeling, so you don't get that nylon woven feel to it. I've touched it.
How did it feel to you?
It felt kind of furry at first, and then someone told me was supposed to be. Yeah, it's kind of like furry paper almost, and I was like, wait, what? No, and someone at Apple was like, no, it's meant to like be like suede. And I was like, ah, okay, it feels like. Yeah. So it differs depending on the thing I was touching, right? When I touched the new like wallet case for the MagSafe wallet case in fine woven, that felt premium. And I think it had something to do with the sort of nuts and bolts under the case, the frame of the case itself. Whereas when I was touching a magnetic loop or a different iPhone case for the iPhone 15 Pro Max that just some person standing out in the demo area had, that felt almost not cheap, but just not as great. So it does feel like suede, but it can be different depending on what
it's
on.
That is very much like suede too. Like there are suede things that feel awful, and then there are suede things that feel great. So
So my thing is, I get a little like I have not tryptophobia. What that is, I have a bit of a texture reaction to things. Okay. Yeah. So lenticular cards are my worst nightmare. I can't touch them. It's just terrible for me. So I get a similar feeling from this.
You really
shouldn't
reveal that information, Trillin.
I know to everyone.
Another thing
not
that we can just
gonna
use against you in the future. But okay. I'll file that away.
It's like rats and lenticular things.
Lenticular rats. Let's get some hidden Trillin's desk.
Oh my God. Anyway, fine woven, I did also see it on a magnetic loop band for the Apple Watch Series 9. That one also felt fine. Again, Apple's thing is like they wanted to feel premium. I'm like, sure, I guess. I also think they're not set in stone with fine woven. I think they may make other materials or finishes for fine woven or similar types of things.
Dana mentioned that it was funny that they didn't talk about vegan leather, which is something a lot of companies do, which is fake leather, pleather, plastic. I think Apple's like, we're never going to say that because that is basically a plastic material and we're just not going to play that game. We're going to do our own game, you know?
Yeah. It's also very Apple to be like, to solve this problem, we've made a new material.
We made a whole new
thing. Instead of, you know, we're so smart. We're geniuses, you know, the genius bar. And it's very, yeah, it's very Apple to be like, we don't like leather. So we're not even going to say the word vegan leather because we've forgotten the word leather. We've, you know, dropped it from our dictionary.
It's on Apple. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, back to that point about like just, you know, Apple making new gestures or actions and, you know, you being able to launch your shortcut by flipping the middle finger.
I wish. I would love that.
when you mentioned that, the first thing my brain jumped to was action button. I think action button's actually not new to the world of smartphones, to be clear. We remember Samsung with the Bixby button. They refused to let anyone remap. Like, Bixby. Screw you, Samsung. What was that? Anyway, Apple has got the action button in place of the, you know, profile slider. And I can't really talk about how I know this.
Well, in place of the mute slider, right?
Exactly.
Mute slider, typically, yeah.
So apparently, this was a not popular feature whatsoever. Apparently, people would just set their phones on silent and never change it again. I change my slider every now and then.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't know. Y'all listen to this and just don't tell Apple I said it. But in some sort of in a group situation, there was a question asked that was like, oh, how many of you used this slider? And me and Chris Velasco, our friend, raised our hands. And then everyone else in this group was like media or influencers. And it was like maybe like three or four other people. None of them use it. They were like, we leave it and set it. And me and V were the only ones. And we were told we were the minority of people who have iPhones and whatnot. Now joining the minority is you, Devendra. Apparently, I'll say, yeah, we're power users, baby.
Well, it's like, more like, I've talked to people who like just leave their phones in silent all the time because they're always wearing Apple Watches. So they get their notifications other ways. But I don't, you know. And
right.
I need to, if my kid's school calls, I need to be aware of that.
Alerted, yeah.
Be in blissful silent mode. Yeah.
A lot of parents that I know actually do this. They leave their phone on loud, but sometimes you need to change it to silent mode when you go into a meeting or whatever. So,
yeah.
You know, I'm not a parent, but I can find out.
I'm going to use the action button as a mute button. Like, that's me.
Yeah.
But,
so let's go into detail about the action button, which is something else I went ham on during a meeting. I was like, listen, tell me how this works.
Listen, I appreciate that, Sherlyn. Like, let me just tell you, like, when you do these meetings, it's sort of like going back to school, right? Going to college or something. And the kids who are like very vocal will always be raising their hands and asking questions. But I also think a lot of folks are like, this is how often you get to sit down and talk to engineers, you know, ask some questions. So I appreciate it, Sherlyn.
Yeah. Action button, I think I also was able to spend a bunch of time testing it out on a demo of a unit. So I feel like I'm very familiar with it now. It sits where, the volume slider would normally be. And it's quite identifiable by its size. It's smaller than the volume buttons and about the same depth to press, basically. It wouldn't be Apple if it was asymmetrical or
and
whatever.
And I just want to make this clear. The action button is only on the iPhone Pro phone. So it's the only one the Pro 15 and 15 Max, 15 Pro Max.
Yeah. 15 Pro, 15 Pro Max. But the way it works is interesting. It's not just a single press, a simple press that will, you know, change your volume from, you know, ring to silent. It's a long press. And I think this is done deliberately. You want to not, you know, accidentally trigger or change your modes so your phone's suddenly ringing when you think it's, you know, silenced in the cinema. I am skeptical about really, honestly, how well this will work. I think that long press is still as easy to trigger in my purse when I am squeezing it by accident. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
I've accidentally hit the mute switch, you know, like when I'm moving my thing in my bag or something. So that happens too. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So shit happens. But the action button, I think, is more intriguing for me because you can remap it. Because I think, again, so few people are actually needing that toggle to quickly jump between, you know, ring and silent modes that you can use it for something else. And that's nice for me. The options include starting your favorite shortcut, which, you know, if you've used the shortcuts widget at all, you'll know how to, like, create a shortcut, really, and have that be what the action button does. Or you can use it to switch between different focus modes. You can trigger the camera or the voice recording or voice memo.
I've seen from people you could trigger the camera and use it as a shutter button. So that's actually pretty useful. So you don't have to move your fingers. It's like, oh, something's happening. camera, picture, go.
So the yeah, that's one of my favorite things about Action Button as well. Is like when you're going into each of these settings, you can change, for example, not only does it change focus mode, you can also use Action Button to set it to be like, with one tap, I want this specific focus mode.
Oh, okay.
With the camera button, I want it to be launching selfie mode or long zoom or whatever it is. Like whatever your you know, there's basically different settings within each Action Button action that you can choose to be the default thing that launches. And yes, like you said, right, like when you launch a voice memo or when you launch the camera shortcut with Action Button, the Action Button then becomes the Action Button for whatever's in that app. So it can be a trigger or
contextual,
it can be
Action Button. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, it which is nice. So like basically when you've launched it, you use it again. I was going to start playing around with it to kind of see if it can be used in other apps, in the sense that like if you have an app open and you press the Action Button, what does it do? But what I'm realizing is that basically anywhere on the phone, if you're, say, inside a different app or whatever, and you press the Action Button, it will just do whatever it is programmed to do. So it doesn't behave as a trigger in any other situation unless you first press it to do what you want and then subsequently press it again to launch
that
whatever
sense.
It
That's
is.
That's logical. Yeah.
Exactly. It is logical because you do want this shortcut to be always available for you no matter what your phone is doing. So by default, it is, again, a profile changer for ring or silent, but it's so much more useful
It sounds kind of smart too. Like even when it comes to the mute functionality, like I'm probably just going to keep it there for a while, but there's haptics involved. So when you, I hear when you hold it down, you will get a double buzz that you're in mute mode. And when
you get
out of mute mode, it's a single buzz. Yeah.
Yeah, so when you tap it once, because it doesn't work with just a simple press, there's an on-screen element that says hold down to trigger or whatever. And the dynamic island actually changes to tell you what the Action Button has been designed to do.
Nice.
So, yeah, okay. So you're never like at a loss for what you're actually trying to achieve. I also want to talk about some things that, like, from my hands-on experience that you probably couldn't see in the videos or from the press releases, and that is titanium. I actually think the iPhone 15 Pros now use titanium, and yeah, they're significantly lighter. I don't know the actual number difference, but I know that based on hand feel, this thing.
I've seen the gram difference, like in figure wise, it's like maybe 10%, maybe 9% on the Pro, but
yeah.
I'm more interested. You notice it, right? You notice it feels different.
Yes.
That's cool.
It's also in part because the finish is a bit different. I do like the brushed metal look. I like that it. In my opinion, it rejects fingerprints better. I don't know why I saw on X or Threads that like it's is a fingerprint magnet, but it's actually like a matte finish, very reminiscent of previous Pro models. But the one thing that's different is that the edges are no longer as sharp as previous Pro and Pro Max models. So it feels less like a weapon. And I think in my hands-on, if you've not yet read it, go do, because I've got a lot of written gems in there. I said that if the iPhone 14 Pro Max felt like it would crush my skull into pieces if I dropped it on my face while reading in bed, the iPhone 15 Pro Max feels like it would only gently dent my cranium. So
it could be a little black eye. You know, it's okay.
Yeah, a little bruisey bruise.
Well, that's what I'm thinking, specifically when it comes to the Pro Max, Rylan, because we've talked about this. I've always felt the Pro Max phones have been way too heavy. They basically weigh half a pound. I have big hands, and even I find them too heavy and a little too large. Does this one feel light enough that you would actually want to use it more regularly compared to the normal Pro?
I definitely don't feel like as weighed down by it when I hold it compared to the 14 Pro Max. I still don't want to use this one as my main. I think I'm still going to do a 15 Pro as my main. But I will say, yeah, it's much less of a pain to imagine having to live with this thing for a bit of time while I eventually review it. The titanium feels great. The finishes in person, I've been asked what these titanium finishes look like. You've got the colors of white, blue, black, and, quote, natural titanium, which,
I would say colors, quote unquote, because they're all like, it all looks like metal. And one is a little blue, one is a little black, one is a little white. I would have loved bolder colors, but I guess you can't do that.
Yeah, I know. I'm a little bit annoyed because, like, if you look at the color lineup for the iPhone 15s, which, by the way, might be the best thing about those phones, it's
cute.
So pretty. You've got the pink, blue, green, yellow, black.
And they
awesome.
Have the colors going into the little camera square, too, which is nice. It's just a nice look. Yeah.
It's just the way it's infused into the entire back glass. It's the way they've done it. And it has this frosted finish that looks similar to iPhone Pro models. So if they were able, I mean, Whatever. I want more colors. Apple, if you're listening, give me more colors for the titanium phones for the pros.
I don't think they can because they are so focused on giving us like premium metals on the pro phones, and you can only do so much. Like, that's the unfortunate thing. I'm all in on natural titanium. I like the silver. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's I think not that much more I can really tell you that is like a hands-on impression. I'm trying to think what else.
The zoom? What about the 15 Pro Max extra zoom?
Yeah, to that point, which is like I tried it on the at the demo unit, but I can't really tell you because like I use my iPhone 14 Pro to get up to 15x on a subject far away. It was one of our influencer friends from across the giant room at Steve Jobs Theater, and then I used the demo 15 Pro Max to get to another influencer. I don't know their name, okay. And I got up to 25x. Right, I can't really tell you right how good or
well I mean because if you're going that far you're getting to digital zoom and stuff, right?
So but the optical zoom itself, I mean, I can tell you that like you don't feel anything moving, if that makes a difference. It seems to have good quality, but what I'm trying to say is I can't tell you comparing a sample photo off a demo unit to
You probably didn't have that much time. I totally get it.
But I will say the one thing that I did notice, and I did also mention this in my hands-on, is that like, yeah, as you get close past 5X, in fact, past, I think, 10X or 20X, this little small preview window shows up on the top left of the viewfinder to kind of show you where in the scene you actually are, so that if you needed to find a subject that you've lost track of while you're that close, can find it again. Yeah, so it's pretty much the same as what Samsung and Google do on their like extreme zoom phones, but you know, it's nice to see Apple also like made sure to include it.
I was like, the thing I've been wavering on, because this is my year to upgrade myself, I'm on the 13 Pro right now, I like, do I just go Pro Max? Do I get the big boy screen and everything? Do I get that big camera? And I feel like I'm still more impressed by Apple cramming really cool tech into smaller phones.
Yeah.
So I'm probably still going to go 15 Pro. So yeah.
Yeah,
I
me
feel
too.
Like my mind is made up at this point. How do you feel these phones compare to like the Android competition now, Sherlyn?
I mean, they're closer, right? Because one of the things that Apple had been missing from the Android side of things was this kind of optical quality zoom. I'm curious to see how the new portrait mode actually works. I think it's so intriguing. I think that some of that chat about like different focal lengths in their camera was just, I don't know, more Apple trying to sound like, you know, professionals making prosumer tools and that sort of thing. I don't know necessarily how much it'll impact my daily life. I really want to see how this new rich depth map affects the portrait quality, because it's just been so hit or miss with portraits in iPhones.
The HDR looks better. Yeah.
The cameras really are intriguing now. And if we're talking about the Android competition, let's talk about USB-C. There's a little bit of confusion around the charging speeds, the data transfer rates. So iPhone 15 and 15 Plus, the base models, they support USB 2.0. So you get transfers of whatever the previous lightning transfer rate was, which is, I think, 480 Mbps.
It's like pretty slow.
Slow. If you go up to the Pro models, you have the A17 Pro chip that has its USB little, I don't know, engine or something. And it supports up to USB 3.0, so up to 10 Gbps for data transfers. The charge rate on the two phones is, I asked several times, it is basically the same as last year's models, which is sad, I guess.
I will say that's pretty disappointing. I saw commentary from other technology columnists too. Like there, when Mark Gurman, the Bloomberg reporter who guested with us for the preview, like, he had mentioned like maybe we'll see faster charging because you have faster speeds and maybe, you know, the better USB engine on the pros. I'm a little disappointed we don't have that, but I guess we'll live. I don't know. Like, are Android phones charging much faster these days?
You can achieve faster charging on a lot of Android phones. Samsung actually has quite fast charging, and also because they're using significantly larger batteries, sometimes it makes sense. What Apple will say in its language is that 50% in 30 minutes is kind of what you're going to get. You have to use the, you know, and they don't supply bricks in the box, by the way. So yeah. And what I found interesting is that, yeah, if you buy an iPhone 15, whether it's the Pro or the base, you'll get a new USB-C cable in there. It's the braided sort of cable, so it's a little bit better than your standard will break in 1 year cable. And it
That's
supports
nice. That's something.
Yeah. And it supports the USB 2 transfer rate as opposed to USB 3, regardless of which model you get, which I think is interesting. Another thing I just found out after the event is you can use your iPhone to charge other devices, like AirPods or other iPhones through this USB-C situation at a rate of something like 4.5 watts. It's something, and that puts it, I guess, closer to parity with the Android side of things on charging speeds, on you know, being able to power deliver other devices. I think
Samsung has Apple a little bit here, right? Because you can use the rear of Galaxy phones to just wirelessly charge other devices.
Right.
Which I don't think you can do with iPhones yet. Yeah.
Right. You can't do it with iPhones. You can do it on Pixel. I mean, Apple can barely figure out its own wireless charging.
Yep.
I mean, it supports T2 right now. So, sure, T2. I will say, though, like Samsung, yes, good battery and good battery charging, but notorious for exploding phones. So, I think.
a little problem there.
Not give them so much credit.
I think Samsung's camera work is pretty phenomenal, like from what people are showing off. I see clips on Samsung zooms, like people in the nosebleed seats at Taylor Swift concerts, like doing the full zoom and getting a pretty good shot of her on stage. Stuff like that, you can't really do.
Samsung definitely has Apple beat when it comes to zooming optical lens quality. And I think Google also has Apple beat on that front. But on a lot of other things, I think Samsung does pretty poorly in its cameras. Just if you are the sort of person that will zoom in to see the pixel by pixel sort of situation, Samsung definitely doesn't beat either Google or Apple. Right now, I will say I think the race is on between Google and Apple on the like standard daily photography side, just to see how they do. Arguably, Apple still is and will retain its crown as the best like video camera.
It looks pretty sick. It's covering better formats. It's they're doing the thing on the Pro phones where you
the
can
Asus
plug in
support. Yeah.
You can plug in storage and just like record directly to the storage. Yeah.
To the external SSD.
That's kind of cool. Like actually making them Pro devices. So that's pretty cool. Well, you know what, Sherlyn, I'm sure you're going to be getting ready to head out soon. Any broader thoughts about the event or what you didn't see? Anything you're disappointed by?
I thought the event was not because I was reading back my live blog because I'm narcissistic. And I remember the event started out with this big video that was focusing on like all these people celebrating birthdays that they wouldn't otherwise have had maybe had they not had an Apple device. And I thought that was going to be the whole theme this year. But really, what did we see by way of life-saving technology that Apple introduced this event? Roadside assistance via satellite, maybe? And then don't really have much on the Apple Watch. We have brighter screens. And then Apple seemed to like forget about that and went all straight to like, oh, Mother Earth. It felt not very cohesive as a theme. I think usually we get more of a cohesive or theme around these events. And that's just didn't happen this year. I think it was kind of a mishmash of things. But that's not a huge problem. That's just me, you know, thinking literally and wanting more of a cohesion around event like that. Otherwise, though, I am excited to dig into some of these devices and let y'all know how, you know, I really feel after spending some time with them.
I mean, it's more exciting than last year. I'll put it that way, because last year I had like no inclination to upgrade, whereas now it's like, okay, Dynamic Island and cool metal and some cool stuff.
Action button.
Great. Yeah, good luck heading back, Sherlyn. We're looking forward to your review and your further thoughts on this. Where can people find you online these days?
I am on Engadget.com. I am on Threads at Sherlynstagram, CHERLYNNSTAGRAM. You can always send me emails at CHER@Engadget.com.
Cool. Thank you. Okay, thanks so much to Sherlyn. I hope she makes it back safely because, flights right now are just kind of a mess. Malek, you have not had a chance to speak at all this episode. So do you have any thoughts about any of the new hardware Apple introduced? Because you're our health reporter. I'm sure some of the Apple Watch stuff probably seemed intriguing to you.
Yeah, in terms of the double tap, I thought that it was extremely interesting that they're bringing that to the forefront and they're making it available, not just from an accessibility standpoint, but just for everyone to use. I think it's going to make the watch a lot more easy to integrate into our daily lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think both Sherlyn and I really like the double tap feature too, Malek. And you know, the really cool thing is what this will mean for the future, right? Because this is a gesture we saw in the Vision Pro. And Apple's clearly like just training us for what's next. So I find that kind of fascinating too. But you know, you also spent some time with a very popular wearable, but not from Apple. You spent time with the Samsung Galaxy Watch 6. What is up with that thing?
Yeah, I definitely have some thoughts on the Galaxy Watch 6. So in terms of hardware, the screen display got bigger, sleeker from the last generation. The battery life got improved. But what I really wanted to focus on was how it performed as a health and fitness tracker. And just to name a few of the major updates in that regard, it introduced IHRN, or regular heart rate rhythm notifications, and it finally got FDA approval for this wearable to monitor people's wrists, basically for AFib, which is atrial fibrillation. If you have a heart condition, it'll be able to pick that up. But
doing it the same way as the Apple Watch does? I'm just wondering.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And actually, I was just about to say that it's pretty late to the game. Apple has had FDA approval for its IHRN feature since like 2018. So Samsung is pretty behind, but it is new for them. And then in terms of other things that are really worth noting, it introduced personalized heart rate zones, which basically continues with their theme of customizing your workouts. So it's basically designed, it's a tool designed for runners that will help a runner keep tabs on how their heart rate zone data is doing. It shows them insights on like personal exertion levels. And, you know, by keeping tabs on that kind of data, you're able to tailor your workouts to reach specific goals, whether it's fat burning, endurance improvement, or cardiovascular conditioning. So they are definitely upping their game in terms of fitness, and that might be putting them on par with competitors like Garmin that are really fitness focused.
Yeah. Dana, like whenever we talk about fitness stuff, Dana always mentions Garmin because she is a major runner, and Garmin stuff like was always better, even though it's not as sleek as Apple's or even Samsung's. I'm wondering, Malak, like how does, you know, the Galaxy Watch 6 compare to the Apple Watch at this point? I feel like that is the main comparison a lot of people make, especially if maybe they're considering changing platforms or something. It's getting late to AFib. It's getting late to a lot of features. Do you think it's more catch up? Like, do you think that they're at least on par at this point?
They're definitely catching up. I will say, full disclaimer, I have been a traditional Apple user. I'm not in the Android ecosystem. So a lot of times when I was reviewing the watch, I made natural distinctions between the Samsung Galaxy Watch 6 and the Apple Watch Series 8, which is the latest. They have a lot of the same features in terms of tracking health metrics, like whether it's improved sleep metrics and sleep coaching, or, you know, being able to customize your workouts, or, you know, tracking your menstrual cycle. I feel like they are offering a lot of the same things today, but in terms of sleep, I would say that the Samsung Galaxy Watch 6 is actually more comfortable to sleep with. And I don't know if it's because it has a circular bezel, or if the band itself has a lot to do with it, but I find it way more easy to sleep with the Samsung Galaxy Watch 6.
Tracking like on par sleep wise between Samsung and Apple?
I would say that the sleep tracking capabilities of the Samsung Galaxy Watch 6 are pretty on par with the Apple Watch, but it's comparable to the Fitbit. The only difference is the Galaxy Watch does not have a barrier to exporting your health data, whereas the Fitbit does. You have to be a premium member. So they kind of win in that regard. But in terms of how I would compare the Apple Watch to the Samsung Galaxy Watch 6, they're pretty close. But at the end of the day, the Apple Watch Series 8 costs more. So it comes down to whether or not you're an Android lover or an Apple lover, but they are getting closer in terms of like what features are available.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying closer to the Series 8. I mean, yeah, we just saw the Series 9 get announced. I feel like that alone introduced a bunch of new features too. So it feels like Samsung's always going to play a little bit of catch up, even though they were technically first to getting a smartwatch out there. I remember when that whole story dropped. I know you haven't had much experience with the Pixel Watch, Malak, but you know, just feature wise, is there anything like any major comparison you can make between those? I feel like for Android users, Samsung stuff generally has been the stuff to go to, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think with a lot of the Wear OS 4 software updates, we're going to be seeing a lot of through lines between the Pixel and the Samsung Galaxy Watch 6. We're going to see more third-party app integration. But in terms of the Samsung Galaxy Watch 6 standing out as an Android smartwatch, it really does seem to be that the smartwatch ecosystem is not getting boring, but there's a lot of the same happening everywhere.
Yeah.
A lot of the fitness tracking, a lot of the third-party integration, a lot of the day-to-day usage is pretty much the same, unless you're going for a budget fitness tracker where you won't get as much smart features. And with the Wear OS updates, you're getting a lot more capability to integrate things like the Samsung Galaxy Watch into your daily life with things like Samsung Pay, you know. So
it's happening. Like something is happening on the Android front. You know, when we normally talk about this stuff, Sherlyn is typically the Google fangirl. And I know our listeners always love how much we talk about Apple stuff, too. It does seem like it's nice that the Android ecosystem is getting a little better when it comes to wearables, because I feel like things have been just kind of dead for a while. Google buying Fitbit, it felt like a good thing for Google, but maybe not necessarily a good thing for Fitbit. So I guess we'll see what that leads to for the Pixel Watch. But yeah, any other thoughts on the Galaxy Watch 6, Malak?
Just one final thought. Basically, I can't truly say if it's the best Android smartwatch on the market right now, but my final takeaway after playing with it for weeks is that because of the price tag, it's not a bad buy. But if you are already a Samsung Galaxy Watch 5 owner, the previous generation, you're not getting that much of an update from the last gen. Because most of the updates are software-based, you might not be getting the most bang for your buck. But it definitely is evolving, just not in a major, major way. And I think the room for evolution is getting shorter and shorter if they want to compete with other big smartwatch makers in the industry.
Thank you so much, Malak. And people can check out your full written review of the Galaxy Watch 6 at Engadget.com. Did you do a video for that? Like, can we see it in action?
Yes, we did do a video for that. It's on our channel. I did a review of it mostly as a health and fitness tracker, though.
Very cool. Go check that out, folks. Let's move on to some other news. And I think the big story this week, aside from Apple, is not so good news for Google, I guess. Like the US versus Google trial has begun. We mentioned it last week, and we have gone through, 2 days of the trial so far. Nothing super consequential, although I do think it is fascinating to me to see how much the government's lawyer is positioning this whole situation. So this trial is the government taking Google to task because it believes its search dominance could be monopolistic, that Google did potentially illegal things to keep a stranglehold on the search market and to make it harder for competitors to join in. Specifically, it seems like they're focusing on those deals to get make Google the default search engine on iPhones and other phones, other platforms as well. Like the government is finding that all a little fishy right now. At one point, the government's lawyer said, like, this is a monopolist flexing. I just find that like the language is very strong, and this thing will take a while. Like this trial will last over 10 weeks. It's going to be a while before there are any final decisions. I believe there is no jury for this. This is all up to the judge. But yeah, this trial is something we're going to be following because it means this is the biggest effort the U.S. government has taken against the technology world since the Microsoft antitrust trial. So this could lead to major things. It could lead to a potential breakup of components of Google. So that could be something. Or if Google wins, it could mean like the government's pursuit against other tech firms may be a little more muted. Maybe they won't go so hard because it's very hard to prove monopoly in this sign right now. And you know, the language is very strong. It's hard to say. Like, I've seen people ask, like, okay, what is the judge thinking at this point? He does not seem particularly leaning on either side. The language right now is coming from the government's lawyer. So the government's lawyers are very, very adamant about this case. Like, basically, they have a very strong case. They also mentioned some details, too, that let me see here. On the second day of the trial, Apple's lawyers got in the fray and they contested some information that was leaked out on the first day. The government's lawyer had mentioned that, you know, Google had paid up to $10 billion to Apple and other companies to keep its search engine in TOPS. And amid that whole conversation, they had said some numbers. I'm reading from the Washington Post here. The Apple's complaint is that in the ruling, the government's lawyer specifically said Google paid Apple $4 to $7 billion. They didn't want that information public. But the judge didn't seem to care. They didn't think like that was any privilege information or anything like that. We're going to get a lot of tidbits from this trial. It's going to be going on for a while, but it's a pretty big deal. So pay attention, folks. And yeah, stay tuned for more updates. In other news, I wrote up this thing about Intel officially unveiling Thunderbolt 5. Malak, does the name Thunderbolt mean anything to you? You know, you're a tech reporter, but I wonder, do you even care about this stuff?
If I'm being completely honest, no.
I don't think anybody. I think very few people, even among the tech crew, understand like what the whole Thunderbolt thing is. So let's like refresh here. Intel officially announced Thunderbolt 5. Thunderbolt was this idea that Intel had. Intel and a couple other companies, I believe even Apple was like on board early on. It was like the early 2010s, maybe 2009 or so. But there was this dream of creating a cable, a single cable that could handle data, that could handle power, and that could also push video to like a monitor or something. A single cable that could do it all. And we are now 5 versions in, and it seems like better than ever. So if you see that little lightning cable on some USB-C ports, that's what it is. I think it's one of those things, if you know, you know. If you need a super fast hard drive, if you need like super fast data transfer, you know what you're looking for in something like this. And this latest version, Thunderbolt 5, looks better than ever. I think it really hits a lot of the complaints people have had against Thunderbolt for a while. The total bandwidth for this thing, potentially up to 120 gigabits per second. That is 3 times as fast as Thunderbolt 3 and 4. That's also 3 times as fast as, actually, no, it's much, much faster. So Thunderbolt 5 is built on USB 4. This is a whole dance of names that is going to confuse everybody, but it's hilarious. USB 4 also uses the USB-C slot, can potentially go up to 120 gigabits, but it's not required to do so. So it's all very confusing. Intel's big push with Thunderbolt 5 is that it's just making some straight up requirement that every Thunderbolt 5 port will support at least 80 gigabits per second, potentially up to 120 gigabits. There will be support for 2 6K monitors on a single port. I believe here at least one port will support charging. The technology itself can support up to 240 watts of charging through a single cable, which is pretty impressive because that is, when you're talking like gaming laptops and stuff, those can easily go upwards of 200 watts. So this is a cable that can power your gaming laptops, with an appropriate AC adapter. Seems faster than ever. Seems nicer than ever. It's just more confusing than ever. Because, it's just another Thunderbolt sign on your computer. And you have to look at specific cables to see if, like, they support the specific number of Thunderbolt. None of this makes any sense. But, listen, this ended up being, like, one of our top-performing stories on the site this week, which shows that, like, Engadget readers just really love some of this nitty-gritty, nerdy stuff. And Intel is in the midst of introducing its latest chipset, which we're probably going to hear. We're going to hear more about that in October. So this is all a part of it. A single cable that could do a lot more. I think that's pretty cool. And I just want to get rid of the days where I'm like juggling AC adapters with like the little circle pins. I hate them. I think it's the year 2023. We should be moving on from this. So yeah, Thunderbolt 5 seems cool.
Do you have any idea for how this might impact the smartphone industry? You know, especially after Apple just upgraded the USB-C.
It's funny because we just talked about Apple's whole move towards USB-C. They don't support Thunderbolt at all. Like you have to, with an iPhone 15 Pro, that supports faster 10 gigabits per second USB 4, but none of the Thunderbolt 4 speed. So it's just, we're not really seeing much happening. I think the dream is there. Intel's dream is there. Maybe some Android phone makers can actually do something with this at some point. The thing is, Thunderbolt supports a lot of bandwidth. So the idea is for things like external GPUs, potentially AI accelerators, which don't really exist right now, but maybe a thing, like a little box you put on your desk that just soups up your AI performance for certain tasks. That bandwidth is going to be really useful for those people. So that's a thing. I think it's pretty cool, and we'll be keeping an eye on it. Real quick, I want to mention a couple of things that we also reported on. Marvel Studios VFX workers have voted unanimously to unionize as part of the IATSE union. So that's pretty important. We've talked about the crisis facing the VFX industry and how they are being pushed to work more and work longer hours and not really getting much support from the studios. Like, the studios are just pushing. There's not much actually helping these VFX studios, and they're getting overworked. And I think some studios have shut down because of this whole workflow. So it's not great. Mac, I know you like sci-fi stuff. I'm wondering, like, have you noticed that particular fact? And do you think unionizing could be something that could help the VFX workers in general?
I definitely think unionizing is always a good thing when it comes to highly specified workers like VFX workers. We should be valuing their work and giving them the platform to make sure that the final product is what the general public expects it to be. I think we've gotten so far along in CGI effects in mainstream media, so it would be really sucky to go backwards from here. So I think it's really important that we see that unionizing happening now so that we don't, you know, backtrack from all the progress that we've made in terms of technology.
Mm-hmm. It's funny how sometimes I go back to, like, movies made in the 2000s and the VFX work looks better because they had more time to sit and focus on it. Even something like, you know, the original Avatar, which was a movie, you know, released in the early 2010s. It still looks better than a lot of the Marvel stuff we get because they had the time and the money and the resources really to, it's really time. It's time spent on artistic work that allows things to look very, very good. And the Marvel shows, a lot of the superhero movies, it's not just Marvel, have really suffered from this, I think. So yeah, unionizing is good, potentially will lead to better support for these crews too. Also, in other news, I want to briefly mention the game industry has been a little on fire this week because Unity, the game engine, introduced some new fees I think nobody liked. Broadly, the idea, a lot of indie developers use Unity to publish their games, to build their games, and Unity announced this fee setup where they will charge developers per installation of a game once they meet a certain threshold of two on the Unity Personal and Unity Plus services. These are the, like, subscriptions developers can subscribe to. If you make $200,000 and have 200,000 installs, after that you have to pay a 20 cent per install per game. And nobody liked this. It was kind of a mess. Unity Pro, Unity Enterprise limits are a little higher. It's like $1 million and a million installs before this stuff triggers. But for developers immediately, like, saw what the issues were here, because if you are a small indie developer that has a windfall, all of a sudden, like, your little game has become super popular, all of a sudden, you have to start paying these fees. And depending on the price of your game, it may not be something you actually can afford. If you're doing a free game, which is, you know, generates revenue in other ways, you may be just ultimately screwed. And there were other problems too about, like, what if some like annoying review bombing gamer just decides to, like, install and reinstall their game like 100 times on their computer just to hurt you? What if they gather all their friends to do that too? That seemed like a potential flaw in the system. Unity later came back and said that they intend to I believe like only charge for the first install per user, although that's only the first install for a single device, and I don't know how they're going to track that. Also, things like Game Pass, like, will a game developer pay when somebody downloads their game on Game Pass? The latest statement sounds like Unity is going to pass on those costs to Microsoft or the people running those subscription services. Are you a gamer, Malak? Like, is this something that you think will affect the way you play any games?
Yeah, so I'm not a PC gamer, but I play some Xbox here and there. Xbox.
Have you gotten to Vampire Survivors yet? That's like the main.
No.
For you.
And I'm everybody. Mostly a Nintendo Switch user. Okay. If I'm being
that's on Switch
honest.
Now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I've heard about it. I haven't gotten into it. I still haven't even gotten into the new Legend of Zelda game. I've been putting that off for some time. But yeah.
Probably for the best, because yeah, Tears of Kingdom will just, like, eat up 100 hours of your life.
I
think this will specifically affect indie developers. So if you have a Switch and you go play Vampire Survivors, that's built on Unity. And this whole thing, that's a game that sells for like $1 or like very cheaply. I don't know, like, how a game like that could survive on this engine. moving forward. Unity is trying to try very hard to compete with Epic's Unreal Engine. And I think for indie developers, Unity was like the cheaper thing, the easier thing to develop for. But I think a lot of companies, a lot of devs are just looking at this and being like, well, why would I ever make a game in Unity again? Also, because this company has come in and completely changed the terms of their actual service. So like somebody towards the end of developing a game thought that they were going to be paying like a certain set of fees towards Unity. Now it's completely different and could be completely infeasible for them. Typically in an engine, you pay like a portion of revenue, right? Like you pay, I don't know, I forget how it works for these specific companies, but you may pay like 30% per chunk of every purchase. But that's money coming in, so it's at least money you have to pay back. These fees just seem a little arcane. Malak, I know you want to talk about a couple stories when it comes to like the health side of things. So I know you're waiting to hear about news about when the new COVID vaccine will actually be available. There was news this week that was approved by the FDA. So we know it's like incoming. People are excited to be protected by the latest variant. Any word yet from your health side?
Yeah, so after the FDA authorized the Pfizer and BioNTech's and Moderna's shots for emergency use authorization, sounds very eerily familiar, we expect them to be available as early as today. We haven't heard okay. from, you know.
Does that mean like pharmacies will actually have them today?
Well, I think some it depends on, I think they start distributing starting today, but pharmacies like Walgreens, for example, are making appointments available for vaccines starting on the 18th. But yeah, the CDC, after they recommended that anyone 6 months and older gets an updated COVID vaccine, that pretty much greenlit everything for Moderna and Pfizer. We're still waiting to hear FDA's ruling on Novavax, but in terms of availability, hopefully that's like around the corner. It's just a matter of time.
Gotcha. And I mean, from your perspective, I think it must be tough to be a health reporter right now, Malak, and just see like what has happened to public health in this country post the pandemic, because a lot of people are just saying like, will the public ever really trust government institutions anymore? Like after everything that's happened, this distribution of vaccines, it does seem like the FDA and the government are positioning a little differently. Right now, they're thinking of COVID vaccines like your yearly shot for the flu or something, right? Like it's a different way of selling it to the public.
Right. They're definitely banking on the fact that people will start viewing it as a flu shot. You know, the FDA even put it out in their statement that they expect it to be renewed every year. Will people actually be willing to get the vaccine every year? Who knows? I mean, there's just so much skepticism around the topic of COVID. People have COVID fatigue. Everyone I know in my personal circle has gotten COVID, and it's like, oh, whatever. It's like a cold now. Like, it's just a normal thing. It's part of our lives. People don't want to, you know, make it out to be as big as it was two, 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. So
I think the current stats are like last year, it was around, what, 1,200 people or 1,500 people dying per week from COVID. Now it's down to 600 people. So just a cool 600 people, a cool, like, you know, over 2,000 people a month. It is very weird where things have come, but anyway, but yeah.
There's always the fear that, you know, with these new strains like the Omicron variant XBB.1.5, it has the potential to become a super spreader because it's really good at getting people sick, but it's not getting as many people sick. But only time will tell. You know, falls around the corner, people, you know, get colds, they get the flu, and we'll see how COVID plays out.
Yeah. It's weird that, you know, a pandemic can just continue because people don't want their vibes to go bad. Like, they don't want the bad vibes of admitting that things are dangerous. So anyway, I think the recommendation to I'm hearing this from a lot of health experts too, is to once again start masking up when you're going to crowded spaces. That will also help get these vaccines. Malak, you also tested something that I think you know, came about as Dyson. You know, a company known for really weird high-tech gadgets. They wanted to like create the ultimate air respirator, it seemed, or like the ultimate mask. What is the Dyson Zone?
So Dyson actually released an air filtration / headphone, like right around the time that the Canada wildfires were wafting polluted air into cities like New York. So it was a pretty timely drop. If you remember, like the skies were kind of freakishly yellow and orange. So the Dyson Zone is basically a headphone wearable that has a built-in visor that filters out air pollutants. So it uses an electrostatic filter and an activated charcoal layer that basically removes particulates as small as PM 2.5, PM 10s, things that you can't really see that go into your lungs. And we put this visor to the test. And basically, we did a collaboration with the Department of Medicine at NYU. Shout out to Dr. Terry Gordon and his PhD students. Where basically, we used medical-grade labs tools, a continuous particulate monitor and a particle counter to see how much particles that this zone actually removed from surrounding air. And and we tested it in three settings. So we tested it in a clean lab at NYU. We tested it on a subway station, a really dirty subway station, and then on the street. And the findings were pretty consistent. The zone actually works. It actually filters out the air. We would see the particle numbers drop.
How did you test it? Did you have like a part? Do you have a detector inside the mask?
So I was wearing the actual headphones with the visor, and you could run it on three different settings. We did it on the highest setting, which is the highest filtration rate, level 3. And basically, they stuck this tube up my nose, not up my nose, but in between my mouth and my nose. The tube that was sitting between my mouth and nose was counting how many particles were actually going into my lungs. And it's super like jargony and science. I'm trying to like figure out how to say it in the best way. Basically, someone held a device, whether it was a particle counter or the particle monitor, and recorded the numbers as the visor was turned on and off. And before the visor was turned on, we would see how many particles were in the surrounding air and how much I was breathing in with it off. And then once we turned it on, the particle counter or the particulate monitor would basically give us numbers on how much it was actually filtering in that small space between my mouth and my nose. And
that's cool. I'm glad like we were able to do this more than like a typical product review. So
yeah.
Some extra
yeah.
work here. Yeah.
It was basically like a mini docu-series. We made a whole video on it. It's on YouTube. It's on
Check out that YouTube. You also get to have a lot of shots of you on the subway. And it looks like people just looking at you like, are you Sub-Zero? Are you?
People stared at me. People stared at me. Everyone wants to know what it is. And to this day, people ask me, what are you wearing? It is a huge pair of headphones. But even though this thing worked, the really crappy part about all of it is that it only works for about an hour and a half when it's running on level 3. So if the world is ending, like you're only getting clean air for about an hour and a half.
I mean, there's enough clean air to leave New York, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, but I mean, for $1,000, it better work for more than an hour.
For $1,000, it should do a lot more. Have you seen any other activated, like powered masks like this? We talked about one from Razer, and I don't think they ever actually released it. So,
yeah, I think there's definitely some competition brewing with makers like LG, but nothing at this level just yet. But there are alternatives that are cheap on Amazon. You could go to Amazon and buy like a HEPA filter, a portable HEPA filter.
Actually, I have an activated fan too. Like $200, and they used to recommend it for flights. So like that's a thing. But you know what, Fix? You don't need to spend $1,000 on the Dyson Zone. Just get time to stock back up in your KN95s. You know, like stock up in the masks you used to, and just please be safe out there, folks. Something I think also infuriating, Malak, is that you wrote about this story about the realization that phenylephrine, the decongestant, is a lie. It doesn't actually work, the FDA finds, which I will say infuriates me because there was a study almost a decade ago saying the exact same thing. Anybody taking cold medicine after they like banned pseudoephedrine or at least made it harder to get could tell you that this stuff didn't work. What is up with this news?
Yeah, so phenylephrine, which is found in like Sudafed, Vicks, Benadryl, it's found in cold and allergy medications.
It's found in basically, Sudafed PE. I just want to be right. clear too, because real Sudafed, the real stuff, no, that's pseudoephedrine. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, basically, it doesn't work when it's taken orally. The FDA.
How else are you taking?
I mean, there is a nasal capacity. Okay. You could you know spray it
Does
into
that
your
work?
Nose. It works. So the FDA basically wanted to examine it when it's taken orally versus intranasally. And intranasally, it works still, but orally, it does absolutely nothing compared to a placebo. And that's insane to think because this ingredient, which is in so many cough and cold medications, basically racked in $1.8 billion in sales in 2022.
I hate this whole system.
For all the makers. Right?
Yeah.
So we've been sold a lie for years and years. And
this is one of the things I hope the government like steps back up and be like, hey, wait a minute. Did we just let this go on? Like, we just let, this is why I'm so annoyed at the lack of consumer protections when it comes to health and technology and all sorts of things. But this is a big one. This is, you're just like, yeah, you're selling people a lie. These companies have made a ton of money on nothing. Like, absolutely nothing.
The funny thing is, we don't even know, like, if the FDA is officially going to revoke its over-the-counter designation. I think they're still determining whether or not they're revoking the safe and effective designation that they give these drugs to be over-the-counter. Most likely it will, but the fact that it's just not an outright decision from the jump is kind of crazy.
Makes me so angry. Oh my
and
God.
By yeah. the way, the sales are probably underestimated because they're not even capturing, you know, internet sales or, you know, convenience store sales or the sales that they made at Costco, for example.
So I feel like a crazy person because I've been telling people this for years, like since that whole switch happened. It used to be you could get Sudafed or other decongestants with Sudafedrin easily, like right from the shelf. And then there were fears that people were buying in bulk to make meth, basically, and other drugs. Because of those fears, or because of like that happened a little bit, those things got severely restricted. So they're behind the counter now. You can get them. I believe you're limited in terms of how many you could get, but you have to show your license, to write your ID. You have to be in a database, basically, to get access to these things. And you can get them, but they sure are a pain right now. Do you have any personal stories when you realized phenylephrine was a lie, Malak?
I mean, I personally have always never felt like a huge difference when I took those cough and cold medications. And thought I was gaslighting I probably was gaslighting myself, but I just never really felt a huge relief when I took things like, I don't know, Vicks, Xynex, when I had a cold.
It's infuriating. I will never not be angry about this. Also, like many things going on in the world right now. But anyway, folks, get your real Sudafedrin. Get that. If you go to CVS or Walgreens, you can get like a little sticker and you take it to the pharmacist, or even I think sometimes behind the normal counter. But do the extra work to get the real stuff, because that actually works.
Mm-hmm. I mean, people don't need more reasons to not trust the government. Like, every time there's a new story that's in the health world, people raise their eyebrows. What is going on?
Like, what is going on?
If we can't trust the FDA to actually keep tabs on things like this.
I've seen more than one person say that basically public health as like a resource is basically dead for a generation now because of what happened post-COVID and everything. But anyway, that's a whole other podcast.
Nothing has felt normal since COVID.
Nothing has felt normal. Malak, I definitely want to get you back on at some point so we could just like talk about the failure of public health right now in America and around the world. How about something fun? Let's end with something fun. You wrote about this story. You wrote about Honda's adorable little Moto Compacto EV electric scooter. It's very cute. Can you describe this thing?
It is so cute. It is about like 41 pounds. It looks like a box when it's folded up. It's super, super small. It's a micro scooter. Basically, it's putting Honda into a new category of personal use electric vehicles, or not vehicle. I wouldn't call this a vehicle. I'd call it a scooter for
it's
sure.
It's still a vehicle. It still moves. Yeah. Come on.
But the thing is, this thing only goes for 12 miles. So
that's New York. That'll get you to the top of Manhattan from the bottom of Manhattan.
It takes three and a half hours to charge. I mean, this thing is not super practical. Maybe it's good
for
a college student.
That's super practical if you live in the city. Yeah.
If you live in the city, you can fold it up. You can fold it up and put it on the subway. You can fold it up and take it up, you know, five flights of stairs like I did in my old apartment. But I mean, this is a cute little thing. But how practical is it? I don't know. I mean, who's the buyer here?
They've talked about micromobility as a thing because electric scooters and like rentable electric scooters became a thing in a lot of big cities. One of the nice things New York did is never let those companies like have free reign like they have elsewhere in the U.S. This thing looks really cool. There is a video of it in your report too. So just imagine like sitting on a little seat on top of a flat box, not an open box, but a flat box, and it looks. Ridiculous.
It kind of looks like an Xbox to me. I don't know.
It kind of looks like an Xbox. Like,
I don't know.
Like the Series X, but tall and very thin, but it has handlebars and a tiny little seat. It looks adorable. I think it looks really cool. Yeah.
There's a photo of a woman riding it in their press materials, and she literally looks like she's about to fly off.
She looks like she's about to fly off.
She's bigger than the actual thing.
I think what weird thing is that photo is not in the reporting because Honda was like, maybe we shouldn't show people actually sitting on this thing. there was a late night note from Honda. I was like, maybe let's not actually see it in action. I think you can see people riding it in the video. It is really thin. Like, it looks like something that you can like lean against the wall and charge up. Like, if you're in a ultra compact, like tiny apartment, it seems like you would even have room for this thing. So
I'm sure there's a weight capacity. I don't know. Just
Yeah.
I don't know how safe it is. I mean, for it being $995, sure, maybe it's like a cute Christmas toy or some, not toy, let's not call it that. But
let's not call it a toy.
Yeah. scooter for your kid or your teenager.
E-bikes are like a new thing, especially they're becoming more and more popular in suburbs and cities because it's easier to get around versus versus waiting for the subway or waiting for the bus or something. So
I'm personally not a fan of anything that accelerates super quickly because I have a tendency to fall off of things.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I get it. I totally get it. It's totally dangerous. But hey, this is a cool, cool thing. I see Ben, our producer, says it looks like one of those sentries from Portal. It does kind of look like that. It looks like it's a really cool sci-fi-esque design. I just think it would be hilarious to see somebody actually riding this. Like, I think it looks more ridiculous than somebody on a Segway. And whenever I see somebody on a Segway, I'm like, oh, yeah, those exist. Those are a thing. If I see like a mall cop or something on a Segway. Let's move on to what we're working on. Anything you want to mention, Malak, that is coming up for you?
I'm working on a guide on budget fitness trackers. I'm looking at a bunch of different fitness trackers that are under $100, seeing like what's worth your time and money for that little. And I'm also working on, I mean, I've been all over the place. I've been on the news end of things and definitely a story on Apple and its updating health features in the coming watch. Something along those lines can be expected, but a written review of the Dyson Zone will be coming out soon. The video is out, but the written review will be out soon as well. Yeah.
Looking forward to seeing that. Real quick, I'm testing Big Screen VR's Big Screen Beyond VR headset. Big Screen is a company that has made an app for watching movies in VR headsets. Now they made their own headset. It is really small. It's the lightest headset ever made, but I have to still fully set it up and do some testing on this thing. It's unique, but man, it's $1,000 and it doesn't come with a lot of the equipment you need to actually run VR stuff. So it is one of those things for like the big VR heads. Maybe it'll be really cool with them. But yeah, stay tuned for my thoughts on that. Let's move on to our pop culture picks. Anything real quick you want to shout out, Malak, that you're watching or reading?
For no reason at all, I just started binge watching this show called The Between on Netflix. It's super old. It's like 2015.
It's not super old.
It's pre-pandemic. Anything pre-pandemic is old. It stars Jeanette McCurdy. It's basically this weird sci-fi show about a mysterious disease that kills everyone over 21 years old.
Oh, that's fun.
And people in this small town are dropping dead if they're over 21. And the government has quarantined them. No one trusts the government. No one knows what's going on. Now you have a bunch of like teenagers and kids running around this town, running the town, and it has some interesting political themes. But yeah, a lot of cool. I have no idea what got me into this.
This was actually a Netflix show. It looks like I don't remember this existing at all. I don't remember this ever coming out. So okay.
Yeah, I mean, how did you stumble onto this?
Like, that's my question. Where did you find the show?
I was looking for a show like Into the Night, which is this really interesting sci-fi show about people on an airplane that have to keep flying to run away from a killing sun. I mean, it sounds ridiculous when I say it like that. Uh-huh. And I put More Like This, and this came up, and I said, you know what? I like Jeanette McCurdy. I like her book, I'm Glad My Mother Died.
Good book about like her crappy childhood celebrity experience. Like, yeah, that's a whole thing. Well, I'm glad you're checking that. Anything else you want to shout out, Malak? You did want to mention House of the Dragons.
Oh,
so you are watching House of the Dragons, right?
Yes, I'm on the finale right now. I've been putting it off because I don't want it to end. It's really good. It started slow, I will say. Like, I was kind of bored in the beginning, but I persevered and I kept through. The plot gets better. It's pretty interesting. It won't ever be as good as the original, obviously, but the characters are compelling. The world is compelling.
I'm like two episodes from finishing it, and that was like when it came out. So I got to get the motivation to go back. Okay, thank you so much. House of the Dragon. You're watching this other show that Malak is watching, and I think we're going to have some conversations about like, how you're discovering things. Have you seen Station 11 yet, which I think is the quintessential pandemic kind of related thing?
My suggestions all the time, though.
Put that at the top of your suggestions. Come on. But yeah, that's on HBO Max. Everybody watch that. Real quick, I want to say I'm catching up on Ahsoka. You know, we talked a little bit about it here when it premiered, and I thought those first two episodes were a little slow, a little like languorous. In episodes 3, 4, and 5, it does really pick up the pace and become more like proper Star Wars. And there are moments where I just want to like get up and clap because there are some great lightsaber battles, great drama. There's a dogfight amid space whales, and the music just started swelling. And I just want to be like, man, this is good. This is so good. This is Star Wars. So Ahsoka is giving me a lot of that joy right now. So I'm glad it's still happening. Check this out too, Malak. Although I feel like we need to have a sit down conversation about things you're watching and things I could recommend to you. Because this between show, I'm just looking at it on IMDb. This feels like a cry for help. Oh my God.
It's probably like a hate watch. I'm not going to lie. I'm trying to get out of reality TV. So I'd rather have something sci-fi in the background. The acting is okay, but the idea is there. It's there.
Thanks so much for joining me, Malak. This was fun. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find me online at @Devendra on Twitter, @Devendra at Mastodon, that's social, @Devendra on Blue Sky, you know, everywhere, all the major ones. Malak, where can we find you on the internet these days?
You can mainly find me on Twitter at Malak Saleh, or MalakNSaleh. I had to drop my middle initial. And on Blue Sky, even though I am not active, I will admit, but mostly on Twitter.
It's getting better. They just hit 1 million subscribers. So Blue Sky. Okay, cool. Follow Malak, everybody. Email us at podcasts@gadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. Thanks, folks. We're out.